I was thinking first is maybe tell you a little bit about myself. Children are fine. It's okay. Can talk about balancing life with children. Children aren't fine. That doesn't make any sense. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about myself. And the reason that I would like to do that is that I think it's very important that when we're discussing practical things in spiritual life, we should work with people who've actually experienced those things. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. So I was in the Grihastha Ashram for 23 years. I'd been in the Vanaprastha Ashram since 96. So how many years is that? 17 years now? Yes. Right? 19. Oh, my goodness. And we raised three children, and I now have 13 and a half grandchildren. My husband and I started two gurukulas. Most of the time that we were also running a gurukul, we had other kids living in our home. So some of the students lived in our home whose parents were at a distance but wanted their kids to live in the, to go to the school. So we generally had at least one and up to four or five other kids living in our house besides our own children. And 5 years I ran a preschool, and altogether 18 years I ran Gurukula, total of 27 years teaching kids. 1 year I was an administrator in a government primary school with 450 kids. Of the 22 years that I was a Gurukul teacher, 17 of those years I took the children to the morning program. So we required that the children attended the morning program at the temple. So that meant, I mean, we always brought our own children to the temple, so we brought our own kids every morning to Mangalartik and the whole temple program. But 17 years, I was also bringing the students, so I was in charge of anywhere between an extra 5 to 30 kids during the morning program at the temple. There was 1 year when I had an outside job, a full-time job, when I was administrator in a government school. So that was a job where I had to get to work at like 7:20 in the morning, and sometimes I was there till 9 o'clock at night. So that's my something of my background of experience. And even now as a Vanaprastha, I help out my kids. You know, especially when they have a baby, I may go a couple months and I'm practically like running the household and taking care of the older children and doing all the cooking and the cleaning and all that kind of stuff. Okay. That gave you some background of where I'm coming from. What I thought we would do, if we want to have this as a general topic, I actually have a whole presentation with multimedia and stuff on this topic, by the way. But if we wanted to have this as a general frame, I'd like to have it as just an open question and answer rather than my just giving you something packaged. But if we keep it in this frame, and we could maybe do that for like 40 minutes, and then we could have an open Q&A and discussion on any topic, and just open it up in general for any topic. Is that all right? Does that sound okay to everybody? So anything you'd like to ask on balancing your devotional life and your family work life? And by the way, I don't at all in any way whatsoever claim to have all the answers on this topic, nor do I claim that I will have the answers that will work for you, but hopefully we can at least come up with some ideas and some principles that you may be able to take from that and say, okay, well, I could do that. Or I could try this, or come up with your own inspiration. Is that all right? So, anything in particular that you'd like to ask? Yes?
I'd like to ask, did your children become devotees? Did they stay devotees?
My oldest son and his wife are initiated by Satsupa Maharaj. And my daughter and her husband are second initiated by Bir Krishna Swami. Their teenage daughter just got first initiated. And my youngest son is more like a congregation member, but he's still a devotee. He ran a prasadam business. He ran a company that makes prasadam for about 3 years. Yes.
I've got one question about more older children, or I guess in families in general. Like in the very early days when your children were growing up, and ISKCON was a lot more temple based, and
yes.
many of the families were in communities or in larger communities. So there was a guruku, or everyone was living close together, and was a much stronger community mood. Mm-hmm. Now these days, particularly in many of our cities around the world, it's tough. It's really hard. Most of us, even if we were used to be temple devotees, we're not anymore, and that's really really hard. It's also hard on our children because they don't get that strong mm-hmm. association of having a lot of other young devotees who are, you know, kind of. So I mean, how do we? how do, from your experience, how can we? So I'm not learning this very well, but do you get the?
I think we're growing up.
Yeah.
If we're going to have the holy name in every town and village, and we're going to have a movement that encompasses the world, I don't think we can have just insulated communities where everybody lives in an ashram. I mean, I remember my mother saying to me, okay, you guys live in a temple, and you go out and you sell your books, and the people who buy your books live in a temple, and if everybody bought your books and lived in the temple, you wouldn't have anyone to sell your books to, and then your movement would stop. And at the time, I thought, oh, she's so critical, but she was right, you know, and we're maturing, and we're becoming a society. And becoming a society means people are going to, what does it mean to be a householder? It means you have a house, you know, what a radical idea that was back in the 70s. You know, if you were a householder with a house in the 70s, you were in Big Maya, which is rather peculiar. So the idea of having a house and going in communities is something that I see as the maturation of our movement. And also, you know, in the early days of the movement, when we were raising our children to be devotees, I think our concept of them being devotees was very immature. What would they do as devotees? We really didn't have a clue. You know, I guess they were still just going to live around the temple and go out and do books all day. I mean, it was just... We really didn't think of them becoming doctors and lawyers and entrepreneurs and people working in the world, but that's what we need. We would like to have the government run by devotees. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
Would it be nice if the businesses were run by devotees? If we could take over, you know, Monsanto with devotees? That would be really nice. That's what we're looking for. And in order to do that, we have to start integrating more into society. It's just, right? I mean, also, we're not going to make a lot of members if we're a very insulated movement, because very, very few people are willing to have that extent of a radical shift in their lives. And frankly, even most of us who were willing to have that shift weren't willing to do it long term. We weren't willing to be so completely culturally isolated for decades and decades. Hardly anybody's willing to do that for their whole life. So then it becomes a challenge. I think it's something like when you become a teenager and a young adult and you move out of your parents' house and you get your own place and you kind of, how do I do this? How do I be a grown-up without my mommy and daddy just taking care of me? You know, it's a little challenging. So our movement is sort of going into that phase. And we're saying, all right, how do I raise my children as devotees and yet be part of society? So do you have a specific question? I mean, that's an observation, that it's a different skills perhaps are needed. I do think that it's important to keep connections, even though it's a little harder when you have to drive for 20 minutes than when you can just walk. Mm. I've thought a lot about the Orthodox Jewish communities. They have a rule that on the Sabbath you can't do any work. And they define work like, you know how Krishna says the sannyasi is not he who lights no fire and does no work? Mm-hmm. So they define work like that. You can't light a fire. You can't cook. You can't turn on a light switch. You can't drive a car. Because you can't drive a car, because everybody has to go to the temple on the Sabbath to worship. That's required. And because you're not allowed to drive a car, what do you think it does to their communities?
Missing close together.
They have to live close together, exactly. Because they have those rules. I doubt that the religious leaders who made those rules, you know, thousands of years ago thought about the social effect of those rules, but the social effect is that the communities all live within, everybody lives within walking distance of each other. And we have situations where we're a very tiny minority of the population, and we don't live within walking distance of each other. You may be in a situation where you don't live within walking distance of any other devotee. Maybe you don't even live within easy bike riding distance. I was thinking, you know, I visited one of my childhood homes recently, and I used to be able to walk to most of my friends' houses or get on a bike and bike to their houses. You know, I very rarely depended on my parents to drive me to their houses. So then on top of that, if your children go to non-devotee school and most of their friends are non-devotees, then it's really quite difficult. And I think we have to make extra efforts to come together as a community and do things as a community and have community events and community projects that involve us and our children. And I mean really involve the children. As in really, really involve the children. Not just that this... One thing we have very much in the West is that there's, you know, adult society and there's children's society, and they don't match. So we've brought this into our temples where there's a program for the adults and the kids have to be taken out and do something else with them. But at least still in India, in the villages, it's not like that. And if you who grew up in India out of the cities, you know, it's not like that. There's no such thing as the adults and the children. It's just everybody does everything. The children are welcome at everything and they're part of everything from the beginning. They're part of the society. And then if you look at the old way of education, I just attended a wonderful seminar about Gurukula. And he was making the point that people weren't separated by age. You know, the idea of a school where you're separated by age comes from the Industrial Revolution. That system was designed by the same people who designed the factories. It wasn't designed by people who were educators or psychologists. So in a traditional society, kids went to school with a group of kids of different ages. So it wasn't like this separated society. And I think this is one of the main things we need to consciously do, is have programs where adults and children of all ages are together, working on projects together, and working on the mission together. Do we have a lot to do? Could we, I mean, between where we are now and making Perth Krishna conscious, there's not much to do, right? So if you think of all the different projects that we could do, that we could engage our children in and engage ourselves in, I think that that's a big part of the solution. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's enlivening. Does that help at all? A little? I mean, instead of seeing your living situation as, oh, now we're just so much in Maya and our temples can't support us and now we're just doing this and we just have to go through it till we're old and we can go sit at Radha Kund and chant and then we'll be Krishna conscious. Instead, you can see it as part of the evolution of our preaching society. Interpret it differently. That we're in this situation to integrate into society. Yes?
It seems like we might need some counselors. You know, we've had, when our kids go to normal schools, they get some problems with identifying the two things, even if it's a Catholic school or, you know, so we get some kids that have come out kind of quite frustrated and. You know, and we haven't got any counseling system or anything.
That's a really good idea. We need some sort of a template, both for the adults, not only for the kids, but for the adults. Mm-hmm. And what you're looking at here, to a large extent, is a principle of sociology. and the relationship between religion and culture. So what we tend to call conservative or right-wing people in ISKCON, generally, not always, but generally means that they feel that the only valid expression of Krishna consciousness is through Vedic culture. That Krishna consciousness must be expressed in a certain cultural way. And any other expression is not genuine Krishna consciousness. Of course, there's a problem that we're not exactly sure what Vedic culture is. That's a problem. And by that, do we mean Indian culture? And if we mean Indian culture, do we mean in the Punjab or do we mean in Andhra Pradesh? Do we mean in the cities or in the villages? Or I just came from Indonesia where they're Hindus in Bali, but they're certainly not Indians. Mm-hmm. Not physically and not culturally. So they have a very different Hindu culture. And then the people we normally call liberals are the people who say, no, you can be Krishna conscious in any culture. And then there are people kind of in the middle, we call them dialogic, who say, well, we can negotiate what aspects of other cultures we can use to express Krishna consciousness. Now, if you take the position, it's called an exclusive position in sociology, that only in your native culture can you express your religion. If you take that position, that any expression of your religion in a different culture is not a genuine expression of the religion. I mean, that if, in other words, if you offer Krishna pizza, it's not a real offering. You can't express bhakti that way. It's just not real bhakti. When you take that position, you put people into a situation where if they're dealing with a different culture and living in a different culture, they can't also be a devotee. Do you all follow the logic of this? If you say the only way you can genuinely express Krishna bhakti is in Vedic culture, whatever Vedic culture is. But here you go. You have to study or work in a non-Vedic culture. But the only way you can express Krishna bhakti is in Vedic culture. But you have to be in a non-Vedic culture. So what are they going to do? Either they have to have two personalities, one that's in the non-Vedic culture and is not in Krishna consciousness, and the other that's in Krishna consciousness in the Vedic culture. And they have to jump back and forth between those two persons. Or they have to give up one or the other. They have to renounce the other culture, or they have to renounce their Krishna consciousness. And I think this is a situation that a lot of kids end up feeling. Would you like some oil for your head?
It's okay. It's just a bit of a headache.
Here. It's a loan, not a gift.
Thank you so much.
Sure. What we're saying to them is how, you know, you can't do it. So if we want to say to our children, go and get your education in a situation that's culturally very different, then we have to have a different sort of belief about the practice of Krishna. No, just roll it on your head. Then you have to have it on your fingers. Yeah. We'd have to have a belief that there's some sort of a negotiation and some sort of a dialogue. It's not just the oil, it's the process of rolling it on that helps, by the way. Because when you roll it, you hit the trigger points on your head and knock them out. Don't ask me why I know that. Please don't ask me. So then we have to have a template, like you're saying, some sort of counseling system. How do you do that? And I think we need that for the adults, too, because I think a lot of the adults, especially those who were trained in the ashrams, which should have trained them how to do this, by the way. The ashram shouldn't have trained you how to be Krishna conscious in an ashram. The ashram should have trained you how to be Krishna conscious in the world, because the ashrams are meant to be a school from which you graduate and you go and be Krishna conscious in the world. And this is also something we need to train our children in. Now, my personal feeling is that children should not be going to non-devotee schools when they're young. That's my personal feeling, that you're asking way too much of a child who's not making these as their personal choices. They haven't yet really made a personal choice, I'm dedicating my life to Krishna, nor have they really made a personal choice, I want to go be in a school in the outside culture. They're not capable of making those sort of personal choices yet. And we're putting them in a situation that we as adults find difficult to negotiate. I mean, it's difficult to be at a job where people don't respect that you're a vegetarian when you're an adult. That's hard when you're an adult. You know, when I worked in a government school and I was completely incognito as a devotee, except one person there knew I was a devotee. And I tell people I'm vegetarian, and in a big school, 450 kids, every day it's somebody's birthday, or more than one person's birthday. And so every day there was somebody had a party in the school, and because I was the assistant principal, they had to give me some of the food. So every day several people... I mean, putting aside the fact that if I'd eaten all of that, I would be, you know, about this big. But every day, somebody dumped food on my desk. And after a couple weeks of saying, you know, I don't eat meat, fish, and eggs, and it just didn't matter that I said that, because the next day, again, they would bring something. And how to deal with that? At least they brought it to my office, and they didn't expect me to eat it in front of them. You know, I wasn't in their room, so I could just give it away or throw it away and... You know, I gave up trying to explain to people. I just completely gave up. It didn't go anywhere. It didn't work. People just, they didn't hear it or something. But for the kids. So I should tell you a story about that. I used to walk around the school every day, visit all the classrooms. And once when I popped into a classroom, it was snack time. And the teacher wasn't there. There was an assistant teacher there. So I sat on the side of the classroom because I would observe every class for 2 to 5 minutes a day. And she was just talking casually with the children, and she said, they're all eating their snack. She said, so what's your favorite restaurant? And I had a thought. And my thought was, I wonder what it would feel like to be a devotee kid in this class right now. Now, you know what it's like when we have these thoughts and Krishna hears you. Yes? Yes. You've sometimes had a thought and Krishna heard you?
Yes.
So I had that thought, and then I promptly forgot that I had that thought. Are you all following me?
Yeah.
Okay. So there, I was at a place where there was no devotee restaurant. There was no Govindas or anything in that area. So the teacher's asking one kid after another, and I start thinking, I hope she doesn't ask me. I hope she doesn't ask me. I hope she doesn't ask me. And then, of course, the teacher asked me. So what's your favorite restaurant? And then I thought, what do I say? What do I say? Thinking about this later, for me to think, what do I say, is very uncharacteristic. I don't usually think, what do I say? But I was really panicking. And then I said, well, I don't eat in restaurants. Now, I was the assistant principal of this school. And the children, when I said that, said, ew, that's so weird. Now, the kids wouldn't do that to the assistant principal of the school. This whole thing was very peculiar when I thought about it later. It just wouldn't the way, they wouldn't even talk like that to their teacher, what to speak of one of the school administrators. And then I kind of felt like I was folding into myself, and I wanted to leave the room, but I didn't feel like I could leave the room. And the teacher says, well, why don't you eat at any restaurants like that? Why don't you eat at any restaurants? Which again, this was an assistant teacher, and I was her boss. And again, I thought, ooh, what do I say? What do I say? And then I said, well, I believe it's not just what you eat that makes you healthy. It's the consciousness of the people cooking. And again, all these kids, I think they were about 11 or 12. They looked at each other and went, ew, isn't that the strangest thing? It's so weird. They were all talking like that. You know, and again, I kind of felt like folding. And then the assistant teacher, she started saying, well, that's really weird. And I said, well, you know, I used to work in a hotel as a cook, and my father ran a food company, and but I felt like I was defending myself, and I really felt like I was being attacked. And I said, and a lot of people who work there, you know, their mentality's not very nice. And again, people just made these faces at me and said, yeah. And then I left the room, and I'm walking down the halls. And for 10 minutes, when I'm walking through the halls, I just felt like, I'm so weird. I'm just such a freak. What's wrong with me? And then another part of me thought, why are you thinking like this? You know, you've been a devotee for a long time. You've walked out in public in a sari and tilak now for decades, and you've been comfortable with being weird. What is your problem? Why is this affecting? There was like two parts of me. There was one part of me that was just going, oh, I don't have any friends, and nobody likes me. And then there was another part of me going, what is your problem? Why is this bothering you? And after 10 minutes, then really, clearly, Super Soul said, well, you asked. And I thought, oh. That's what it's like to be a devotee kid in these schools. Because the whole thing was so bizarre. I mean, it was completely bizarre. There is no way that the kids or the teacher would have treated me like that normally. Wow. And there is no way I would have felt panic like that normally. I'm normally a very confident, self-assured person, and I'm completely used to the fact that I am that I am not normal in the society. So it was the whole situation was quite interesting. And that's what it's like for our kids, and that's what it's like for them every day. And that's just about food. That's not even about other things. Yeah, I remember walking in a classroom, 7-year-olds, and one kid came in from using the toilet, and the teacher said, oh, thank you for coming in so quietly, and she handed the kid a piece of candy and said, here, eat it. And I thought, you know, you're 7 years old, and your teacher says, here, eat it. What are you going to do? And then what to speak of other things, like they were reading a story one day when I walked into classroom about how you are the body. You are that body. Who are you? Well, you are your curly hair, and you are your straight hair, and you are your brown eyes, and you are your blue eyes. And I was thinking, whoa. And, you know, how do you, what do they do with that water? How do you deal with that? How do you respond to that as a child? And it's very hard. And sometimes the parents think, well, if we all send our kids to the same school, they'll have each other. But what happens is the research, the people who've done research on devotee kids in outside schools show that the kids will either be very open as a devotee and have very few friends and be very socially isolated, or they try to merge with everybody else, which means they'll deny their devotee friends. They'll actually stay away from their devotee friends in school. So the fact that they have other devotee kids in school doesn't help. And this is, I think it's a serious problem. And just counseling them how to negotiate that, it's not so easy. I found as an adult with, you know, decades in the movement that it was hard for me to negotiate being in a place where I couldn't be openly a devotee. It was not easy for me to negotiate it. I found it exhausting.
You can't defend yourself, you know, as a devotee. I found with my grandchildren, my daughter is not, you know, they're like her subject, yes, but they're living normal lives. And my grandkids, you know, they were told what Chucky believes is wrong. And I can't stand up and say anything to them. They're some kind of Catholics, you know. Mm. But, and then they have kids who have no respect, you know.
Yeah,
it's, you can't have any respect for you then if you can't be who you are.
That's right. You know? I really feel we should have our own schools.
I mean, you're asking me. That's I've dedicated my whole life to having our own schools and homeschooling, and that's what I've done my whole time in the Hare Krishna movement. So I find that very few kids come out well from going to the non-devotee schools. It's a huge, you're putting a huge burden on them. Now, if they have Indian bodies, they have an advantage and a disadvantage. They have an advantage if it's a very multiculturally sensitive, multicultural environment where the teachers are like, let's celebrate everybody's culture, which is happening more and more in the world. So if they're in that kind of a school, then they can present it as, well, as part of my Indian culture. And so they have an advantage that way that the white kids don't have. But they also may have a disadvantage because sometimes when you have an Indian body in a non-Indian culture, you already feel like you're different just by your body, and you don't want to be more different by your culture. So then, you know, it depends how you see it. If you can see it as, well, this is my ethnic culture, and we're celebrating everybody's ethnic culture, it can work in your favor. But if you're feeling like, well, I already stick out just by the way I look, and I don't want to stick out more by the what I believe and how I behave. So it depends how they go on it. I would at the very least choose your schools carefully. Not all non-devotee schools are alike. Some are going to be more supportive of devotee kids than others. Some teachers are going to be more supportive. Some neighborhoods are going to be more supportive. Yes.
Could you speak a little bit about homeschooling, like your feelings about it? I tried it for a few years with my daughter, and we were very pleased with the result. But I think sometimes, because I'm not sure, but I think in India maybe homeschooling does not happen so much. And I know sometimes when I share that with devotees, they were kind of like, oh, no. You know, it's kind of almost like homeschooling is no schooling. So, but personally, I mean, even like my daughter's now 23, but when she was younger, we were also a member of like a local home education group.
Yes.
And I found that even like the Christian or the Muslim home educators, these children, even on a material level, were really quite amazing.
I totally agree with you. Mm. I mean, look, I spent altogether 28 years working in schools. So I'm very dedicated to schools. But I will tell you, the best kids I've seen in terms of character, devotees, not devotees, are homeschooled kids. I'm sorry. That's what it is. The homeschool kids' character, generally. I mean, obviously it's a generality, but generally, devotee families, not devotee families, tends to be much higher. Their character, their behaviors, their values tend to be much higher. Exactly why that is, I'm not really sure.
Peer pressure.
It could be that. I think also there's very few schools that properly imitate life, and that our modern system of education is so far away from life, and so far away from making the kind of demands that life demands, that it doesn't really prepare people for life. To do well in school does not demand of you the same values and character that life demands of you. And so there's no particular reason to develop those characters and those values. And artificially doing it, okay, we're going to have a class on, you know, I mean, it's just stupid. Let's all learn about responsibility. But when you're homeschooled, you don't have to have responsibility. You have responsibility. You know, it's just there. Okay, you're cooking lunch today. You know, every Wednesday you cook lunch, and you take care of your little brother, and you help with the shopping, and, you know, you're in life. Whereas schools divorce you from life and give you all sorts of artificial situations where you don't really have to develop your character. You don't. There's no particular reason to. And so they don't. That's my own personal theory as to why homeschool kids generally have much higher character. And as far as education, I mean, there's a book called No Regrets. Forget her first name. Swan. Her mother had 10 kids. And they were part of a homeschooling system. So they got like a curriculum in the mail. The mother spent 2 hours a day on education. 2 hours a day the kids had to sit and do their schoolwork. And the first kid graduated from eighth year of school very early, and they ended up finishing secondary school at the age of 12. Without planning to. It just is what happened when they just had 2 hours of school a day. They finished secondary school by the age of 12. All 10 of their kids got master's degrees by either 16 or 18 years of age. All 10. And they didn't plan on that. That wasn't their plan. And you have, of course, Aruda and her family, where her two kids, you know, went to college when they were 12. And they're now working with a whole homeschool group in America. And she travels, I don't know how much she travels out of America, teaching her system. And they're getting that consistent result. What's my point? My point is that you can give your kids an education in 2 hours a day. You can give them a better education in 2 hours a day. Just think of, if in 2 hours a day, kids can finish secondary school by the age of 12, what's going on out there in the schools? Mostly not educating. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of extra stuff. There's a lot of sports and music and art and this and that, which then if you do 2 hours of academics a day, you have enough time to add. And then there's also just a whole lot of wasted time getting from one room to another and everybody pulling out their books and everybody pointing to problem sticks on page 23. And now this, you know, taking 10 minutes to deal with that behavior problem and this announcement and that thing. Yes? There's very little time spent on actually learning. So even if you only have, even if you only had an hour and 20 minutes a day, you could get your kids as good of an education at the same rate as happening in the schools. So even if you work, you could do that, couldn't you? And if the kids are older, you can sign them up for some distance learning thing where you don't even have to do practically anything. So it's really not that hard. And you can say, well, what about socialization? But if you send them to the outside school, what about their Krishna consciousness? What about their character? So if you send them to the outside schools, you have to give them Krishna consciousness at home. If you have them homeschool, you have to make an effort to socialize them. I mean, my son and daughter-in-law, who they're expecting their 10th child, and they're homeschooling. Well, their oldest kids went to Gurukula for a few years, but now they're in a place where there's no Gurukula. So their two oldest sons are in college. They both went at 16. And they do outside things. They give their kids tennis lessons and stuff where they're interacting with outside kids, devotees and non-devotees. A number of their children have been in Shakespearean dramas where, again, they're interacting with both devotees and non-devotee kids. And so they get chances to do all sorts of things beyond just the school, and have a chance to interact with the outside world. And she's a very casual teacher. She's not the kind of person who starts at 10 o'clock and everybody sits. She's not that kind of a teacher at all, and her kids are going to college at 16. So that's a real alternative, and you can also do things that are cooperative with other families and get together with other homeschooling families one day a week and do a joint program and pull in some of the people in your community to teach some classes. And the classes don't have to start at 8 in the morning. You can have classes in the evening. You can have classes on the weekends. I mean, you don't have to imitate a school. You can learn things by doing them. What a radical idea, you know, instead of just reading about them in a book and filling in little circles, you can go places and do things and do real projects. Maybe you could maybe involve the kids in some genuine preaching project for which they'll have to write things and do layout and do mathematics and negotiate with people. And not a chance.
interest amongst the ladies, do you think what it would be like? Because I do know a few people who are like in the homeschooling group. I could organise someone to give a
that would be lovely.
A talk to
that would
you
be
know,
lovely.
Some of the ladies who've been doing it for many, many years.
Absolutely, and by all means, network with people who aren't Hare Krishna devotees who are homeschooling. When we first started a school in Detroit, the main people I networked were the homeschooling people. Because we were doing a multi-level school and they were teaching multi-level. And I mean, I don't know what it is like here, but where we were in Detroit, the homeschooling conferences were pulling in 8,000 people. And you'd get to see all the resources. And then, I'm not sure how much you have in Australia, but in America we have many companies that just cater to producing curriculum materials for homeschoolers. Mm-hmm. And I mean, all varieties of teaching methods and teaching philosophy, and many of them are generally theistic, and some of them are mildly Christian. Some of them are heavy-duty Christian, which is a little too much, but there's a lot of them that are just like mildly Christian. Some of the materials that are really useful. So there's the ability to get resources for homeschooling, and then you have Aruda who's doing her whole homeschooling based on the Bhagavatam. So the stuff is out there. You know, and you can say, well, it's a lot of... Well, everything's a lot of work, my dear friends. You know, you can't get out of sacrifice. You can move your sacrifice around, but you can't jettison it, because the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. And love means sacrifice. So it's just, what sacrifice do I want to make? Do I want to make the sacrifice of, you know, driving my kid to the non-devotee school and dealing with how they're going to negotiate being in that school and giving them Krishna consciousness at home, which, just to be frank, I don't see happening much in the world. I see it as an idea. Yes, we're giving our kids Krishna consciousness at home. I don't see that it actually happens that much. You know, how many families really do a daily worship and daily philosophy and daily practice and daily instruction? Like we would do in a Gurukul or in a homeschool. I mean, how many people really have the time and energy to do that in addition to everything else they're doing and taking their kids to school? Not really. So that would be my main suggestion. Have the kids negotiate the world when they're a little older, and where once they've made their personal choice to be a devotee, and even then have them do it carefully. I mean, we have to do it carefully. Maybe that wasn't the answer you guys wanted. I'm sorry.
Can I ask you one question?
I want to first ask of somebody else. Mm-hmm. Is there somebody else who has some other question about... Yeah.
I do.
No. I'd rather we don't have unlimited time.
Maharaji, I'm at the stage where my daughters are going into the teens, and my eldest goes to a Catholic college, and the other one will follow. Now, they're at the point where they compare the Catholic values or just the whole atmosphere in the school to Krishna consciousness.
Okay.
And which is great. This is stimulating.
Okay.
And they, because at our yatra, we don't have so much happening for the girl or for the youth in general. So they kind of want to know, why is it that as a community, you know, we don't have anything to offer much to them, whereas outside people offer so much to the younger generation?
Well, they're a lot more developed is a very simple answer. I mean, that's the very simple answer. So Christianity has been very dominant mm-hmm. for thousands of years, and Australia is predominantly a Christian country. Mm-hmm. So we're in an alien culture. Mm-hmm. If you were in Indonesia, or if you were in Bali, or you were in India, there'd be a lot going on that was related to Krishna consciousness, or at least related to something Vedic. And there'd be a lot of programs, and you're in an alien culture. It's quite simple. It's not Krishna consciousness. It's that the number of devotees are small, and they're already you know, very busy and so forth, and challenge them and say, well, why don't you start something?
I did.
But I think this is the kind of thing that that we want to look at also.
What projects or initiatives could encourage the younger ones to be more attracted towards temple life?
People are attracted by a situation where they can really use their talents and abilities and personality and nature for the sake of a higher cause. Mm-hmm. Every single jiva wants to do that. Mm-hmm. That is our constitutional position. What is the perfection of Krishna consciousness? Perfection of Krishna consciousness is I realize my eternal identity and I use that in the service of Krishna. Yes? Isn't that our... Did I get it?
Yeah.
Okay. So even on a material level, if you realize your nature and you use that in the service of something higher, you will feel happy. Even if you're an atheist, okay? If you realize that you're very good at networking people and you use your networking people talents in order to add some value, material value to the society, That will make you feel much happier than if you're either not doing anything according to your nature or you're doing something for your nature just for yourself. What to speak of if you're not using your nature and you're not doing anything valuable for the society? You're in some job that doesn't use your talents and the job has no use for anybody. So that's what everybody wants. So this is a question of saying... How many of you here feel that you are fully using your talents and your nature in your life? Well, look at that. So I think it's, you know, you may say, well, we're already very busy. But, you know, you can be overworked and underutilized. It doesn't mean that you have to get more busy. It means that you have to get differently busy. And when you're differently busy, by the way, you don't feel overworked. When we're busy according to our nature, you don't feel overworked. I mean, you still have to sleep at the end of the day. But you feel enlivened, not drained. Again, physically you have to sleep. It does get to a point where the body becomes tired or the mind just can't think anymore. I mean, we have a limit on a physiological platform. But if you're doing something that's fully utilizing your nature and even stretching you, you feel energized. And the more you give of your nature, the more energized you feel. But we all had that experience. Have we all been in an experience where we were really fully utilizing our nature and we found we could give 150%? And we were like, well, that was great. I want to do that again. And if you're only partially using your nature, even if you're working very hard, you're like, I need a break.
We all do have to retire at once sometime, then that's another problem, isn't it?
Well, that's on the other end of the scale.
So are you saying to engage their natural propensities, in that way they will feel more...
And start engaging our own natural propensities. Why don't we start with that?
Yeah.
Why don't we get together and say, and what can we do? What are my propensities? What are my nature? If I could do whatever I wanted, if I didn't have any constraints of money and time and talent and whatever, what would I do? And then you know what? Start doing it. Mm-hmm. And then you know what happens? Krishna starts giving you what you lack. Yogakshema vahamyaham. He says, Nir yogakshema atmavam, yogakshema vahamyaham. He says, don't worry about what you lack. And all. Just be absorbed in the self. That doesn't mean you just go, Om Shanti. Say, okay, if I could do what I would really like to do, what makes me feel alive, I didn't have to worry about anything else. I didn't have to worry about my service to my husband, to my kids, and my money, and my house, and... What would I do? Then start doing it a little bit. a minute a day, 5 minutes a day, something, take a step. And then Krishna will go, wow! And he'll start adjusting things for you. He really does that. If you think, well, I have all these problems, I can't do it. But just forget about the problems. Seriously, that's not very practical. It is. Pretend the problems aren't there and do something. It doesn't have to be much, something. Now, if you start doing that as adults, then you can start having the kids do it. You can't not do it as adults and just tell the kids, can you go do it? And then you can start engaging your kids like that. What would you like to do? And then you just get this pouring of resources from Krishna on you. I mean, you just get so many resources, you hardly even know what to do with them all. And imagine if we had a society where everybody's talents and natures were 100% utilized and stretching and growing. Would we have trouble making devotees? I don't think so. I think so many people would be coming to us, we wouldn't know what to do with them. So that's the way. You know,
oh, it's too hard, and it's for somebody else.
Then what to do? I don't know what to tell you. You know,
she doesn't have any idea how hard my life is already. You know, I'm just going to make it harder.
It's just not true. Okay, that's not true. That's the voice of illusion speaking, and it's not true. Something. One step towards it. 5 minutes a week, something. You start doing something that's according to your nature. And that's our philosophy, right? Bhagavad Gita? I got that right, right? That's the Bhagavad Gita. Are you the grandma?
Yeah.
No. Is that all right?
Yes. Nail on the head.
By the way, Christian groups struggle just as much in their churches. It's not all what it looks like from the outside. You know. Mm. It isn't. They go through the same things in their churches. Mm. Any other different areas of...
What are the three... challenges you might have experienced being a mom when your kids were probably, say, around 7 or 8?
My God, what a question. My kids were 7. I have to pick 3. I think that is one of the strangest questions I've ever heard. The Stump Urmila question. Well, God, each kid is so different. Mm. Probably just, you know, behavior discipline, probably the top. Next one would be other people not dealing with him nicely. Other devotees telling, you know, being irritated at kids just being kids.
Was there ever a time you thought that, all right, I'm not going to waste my time for the fact that, okay, I can't work on them as a devotee? Did you ever feel like that, like, you know, that no?
I don't even understand what you're saying.
It's like, did you ever had a time where you thought, no, it's getting too hard to make my kids a devotee? I won't work on that.
No,
there was never a time.
No. I still don't think like that.
you were so busy, you had so many children and so much to do, whereas a lot of the mothers have only got one or two, and that's probably the difference.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just, I don't know, I'm just not wired like that. I mean, there were times that I thought, it's still times that I thought, it's really hard sometimes to work with a society of devotees. Especially as a mother, as a woman. There's plenty of times I think like that. It's like, oh man, another temple where I have to stand in the back. And where the kids are all told to be quiet. I still feel like that. It's like, oh, I'm so tired of dealing with this. I get tired of dealing with that. I get tired of dealing with my mind and all my material desires. I get tired of dealing with that. But at this point, my focus is, you know, my grandkids. So I just finished taking another grandkid on a world tour and different temples. Sorry, I didn't bring him to Perth. We brought him to Melbourne and Sydney and Moolambar and Brisbane. Why would I get tired of that? I don't know. Life is hard, you know. What does it matter? You can't, it's not that if you run away from the important thing to do, then life won't be hard anymore. Mm-hmm. If I run away from trying to be a devotee and trying to help my kids and grandkids be devotees, then I won't have any difficulty in my life. Or I won't have any difficulty with my kids. Then you'll have another difficulty with your kids. It's not like that. First of all, life is hard. It's sacrifice. And second of all, the extent to which life is hard is already destined for each of us. Or you can just kind of shift it around. You can say, okay, I want cherry-flavored difficulty instead of strawberry-flavored difficulty, but the amount of the difficulty doesn't change at all. So why not take difficulty for Krishna? Gotta take difficulty anyway. It's not that the non-devotees don't have any difficulties. If I wasn't battling with my mind and my desires, then I wouldn't have any more battles, you know? That's you're just going to have other battles. Why not fight the battle that's worth fighting? Otherwise, you know, what do you get in the world? Nothing! You end up with nothing! And then you start all over again with another life. What have you gained? Nothing! Everything you learned, everything you built, all the relationships you built, all the energy you put into relationships, if it's not having anything to do with Krishna, it's gone. They die, you die, you forget the whole thing, it's just finished. It's like a drama. You know? Okay, in the drama, I'm playing the mommy, you're playing the daddy, you're playing the children, but you don't even, those relationships aren't real. They're not, they're just actors. And as soon as the drama's over, you walk away and those relationships are gone. So without a relationship with Krishna, we're pouring our energy into relationships that poof! It's like putting all your money into a bank and some bank robber comes and steals it all, you know? This is God. Why do that? I'm putting the energy anyway. Why not put into something that's real? Does that make sense?
Prabhupada wasn't so worried whether he was successful or not, was he? He was, and Hari Sori was giving some classes, and he said that he wasn't worried about that, whether he was successful.
Well, that's basic ABC Bhagavad Gita. Fight for the sake of fighting without considering gain or loss, victory or defeat, honor or dishonor. You have a right to perform your prescribed duties, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities and never be attached to not doing your duty. That's just plain old Bhagavad Gita. We're not trying to make our kids devotees so that they'll be devotees. Did you know that? Maybe you're tired because you're attached to the results and you think you're the controller of the results. That'll tire anybody. That will make anybody exhausted. Because you can't control the results. Can you control the results? Can you control the results of cooking a pie? What to speak of changing another human being? I had the funniest, not so funny thing happen at my son's house a few months ago when I was visiting. So I was cooking some bread, and the oven has a timer. And I was also cooking some rice on the stove. And so one of the things, I was using the timer for the microwave for one thing, and I was using the timer for the stove for something else. And when I was finished with the timer on the oven, I thought I turned off the timer, but I turned off the oven. And I had bread in the oven. It's like, why isn't it cooking? You know, when I take it out, it's like, it's been in there for 15 minutes. You know, it's like, put it back in another 2 minutes, but the oven was off. So we can't even control that. You understand? And I'm supposed to control a living entity. I can hardly control myself. I can't make me be Krishna conscious. Okay, Urmila, be a pure devotee now. Tried that. Does that work? Anybody got that to tell me how you get it to work? I can't force myself to be Krishna conscious. And I'm going to force somebody else to be Krishna conscious? I can't make the bread turn out. Hare Krishna. Ahankara vimudha makarta hamiti manyate. That's the fool who thinks I am the doer. That's fruitive work. Then I'm working for a fruit. I want to have a happy marriage, and my husband will love me, and my children will all be devotees. That's a bunch of nonsense. First of all, it's all rajagun. And second of all, you can't control it. So if you're working for that, you'll become exhausted. Everybody in rajagun becomes exhausted. In the beginning, it's all, look out. And in the end, it's like, That's not what we're working for. We're trying to make our kids devotees so Krishna will be pleased. Now, it's about my relationship with Krishna in this moment. I'm teaching my child about Krishna in this moment, so Krishna will smile at me in this moment. Because all I ever have is this moment. I never have a future. There is no such thing as a future. Is it ever the future? Is it ever the future? Is it ever the future? No, never. That's the first part of material illusion, is time. There is no such thing. In the spiritual world, there's only the present. The illusion of past, present, and future is what starts Maya. The glance of Mahavishnu is time. And it's that glance that agitates the modes of nature and forms this whole illusion. It's the spark, is time. There's no time. Putting our hopes and dreams in the future is what firmly binds us to the illusion that I'm the doer and I'm going to enjoy the fruit and all this stuff, which you can't even control. And so much anxiety about trying to enjoy something you can't even control. It never happens because it's always over there somewhere. So why not try to be happy in what you can control? What you can control is how you deal with everybody right now. Am I dealing with my children right now in such a way that Krishna will smile at me right now? And you can control that. And then you can enjoy that right now. And then you enjoy that in the next now. Am I treating my husband in a way that Krishna will smile at me right now? Not so I can have a happy marriage, which you might have one as a side benefit. That's nice. But so Krishna will be happy. And then, frankly, even if you don't have the perfect marriage, you'll still be happy because you'll be happy in Krishna consciousness. Isn't that cool? Then you're not dependent on how wonderful of a man you married and how wonderful your children turn out. You're not dependent on that for your happiness. Then you're what we call liberated. That if your husband's the most considerate, caring person in the world who changes half the diapers, or he's not, you're still happy. because you dealt with him in a way to make Krishna smile, and your happiness comes from Krishna. Your husband can't make you happy. Your kids can't make you happy. I'm sorry, they can't. Try for it, you know. Your body can't make you happy. That's a biggie. Your mind can't make you happy. Your house can't make you happy. Stop investing in any of those things. Only invest in Krishna. Does that mean you don't clean the house? No. Krishna will smile if you clean your house. But you're not cleaning your house, so I'll have a beautiful house in which I will be happy. You're cleaning your house, so Krishna will say, thank you very much for cleaning my house. You're not sitting down and teaching your kid Bhagavad Gita so they'll have the same beliefs in religion as you. And so you can say to everybody, my children have my religion. My poor parents didn't get to enjoy that. And if you're thinking that way, then you're going to probably pressure them and force them and guilt trip them and, you know. You have to have my religion! You want them to fall in love with God. And that has to do with your relationship with Him at every moment, moment to moment to moment. I happen to believe that Krishna consciousness, the way Prabhupada taught it, is the best way to fall in love with God, or else I wouldn't be doing it. So I'd like to think that my children would reach that same conclusion. You know, they may or may not. But at least I'd like them to fall in love with God. When I decided to join the Hare Krishna movement, my father said to me, I'm so glad you're looking for God. He said, I wish you would have done it in our own religion, but that's not what's important. What's important is you're looking for God. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. And am I really connecting soul to soul via the super soul? With my kids, with my husband, with my friends, with my coworkers, in this moment. And if I mess up, well, I got this moment again. Isn't that nice? I don't have to lament for the past either. That never gets tiring. Never. Never get tired of doing that. In fact, the more you do it, the more energized and the more happy you feel. And the less you're affected by anything that happens, which you couldn't control anyway, and that wasn't your business anyway. That was never your job description. Our job description is not get a particular result. Arjuna's job description was not win this battle. That was not his job description. His job description was be my instrument and act in consciousness of me. Mam anusmaram yujicha. Go fight, do your best. Whatever happens, it will be good for you. Doesn't matter, win or lose. The results were as good for Bhishma as they were for Arjuna. It wasn't that Bhishma was the loser because he lost. Both Jatayu and Hanuman were glorious. Then you're liberated. Practical liberation. Yes.
What are a few things that we can do to change ourselves by which the children can learn to be more Krishna conscious? Like, what are a few practical things we can change ourselves?
About yourself?
Yeah, so that, you know, the children get more interested. Like, because they're going to non-devotee schools, and it's very difficult for them, because one day we were having lunch together and my husband happened to switch on the television. There was some meat eating something going on. I just said, oh, just turn it off. And my son, he's 9 now, and he said, oh, you're getting offended by this? I see it every day when I eat lunch in school.
Yes, this is my point.
And I was taken aback. And I
this
was,
is my point exactly.
I couldn't see that for 2 minutes. And my son, he said, oh, I see it every day. There are children sitting beside me eating the same stuff. And
you remind me of one time in a Bhagavatam class. I was, it was hard for me not to yell at the speaker. I was so angry. It was a man who was sending his children to outside schools. And he sat on the Vyasasana, and he said how he went to some local program where he was networking with other people in the government to try to get some facility for the temple. And he said then they served lunch, and he said it was so unbearable sitting there at lunch looking at people with their meat sandwiches. And I had all of my self-control not to say something. Because we were running a gurukul at the time, and he had put his kids in the outside schools, and it was just like, this is what you're doing to your children every single day. And you can't sit and do that one time for 20 minutes. You can't bear that for 20 minutes. And you're asking your children, who are children, and who not only have to see that, but who are probably getting teased about what lunch they're bringing.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I already said what I wanted to say about that. Yes.
I just thought I want to go back to India for my child study.
Uh-huh.
Because here they're going to non-devotee schools. He just started kindy, but still I decided because his behavior is now changing.
Uh-huh.
So, but the couple of my friends, there is, if you just go there and your husband is here, you won't be able to provide the family life and stuff.
You see,
like
this is what I talk about, sacrifice. You cannot find a solution where there's no sacrifice.
So to give them a good education. So.
Each of us has to choose what sacrifice we want to make.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? In Tamagun, you say, I want to have no sacrifice. That is the mood in the mode of ignorance. I want no sacrifice. I want what I want, and I want no sacrifice. Then you pay a big sacrifice later, and actually your whole life is a sacrifice. In Rajagun, you say, I'm willing to courageously, dharmically pay the sacrifice to be a righteous person. But your sacrifice is painful. You take some pride in doing a painful sacrifice, but it's still painful. And then you get to enjoy the fruit sometimes. You have a fruit to enjoy. In the mode of goodness, you do a sacrifice that is willing and joyful. And your sacrifice and your fruit are both tasty because you're doing both the sacrifice and the fruit for your own advancement. In bhakti, you do the sacrifice and the fruit both for Krishna. So cooking the meal and eating the meal are both pleasurable in bhakti. There's always a sacrifice. If you send your kid to a school here in Australia, there's a certain set of sacrifices. If you go to India, there's another set of sacrifices. If you homeschool, there's another set of sacrifices. If you get together and create your own little school and your own little co-op, there's another kind of sacrifices. You say, which sacrifice is better? I don't know. I'm not living your life. But you're not going to find a place where there's no sacrifice. And just, by the way, in India, are they all devotees? I don't know what this non-devotee school in